Mackenzie.
Lamar.
We had to delay a week for this episode, which means I watched this movie about 2.5-3 weeks ago, and I'm reviewing my notes. But if you took everything that I knew about Eve and put it into like a binder, a folder, I'm worried I might have forgotten all about Eve at this point. But
I'll refresh your memory. Don't you worry.
Okay, that's, I'm hope, fingers crossed. But I wanted to ask you, because this was my first Bette Davis film. I'd heard the name so many times, it referenced not only in film, but in music artists and things like that. And, you know, was kind of blown away by her performance here. So do you have a favorite actor slash actress or one of each from this era? It doesn't have to be somebody we've talked about this month, but just curious.
Yeah, I mean, that's hard because, well, one, it's always hard for me to pick these things. But also, I think they do such different genres. Like, I wouldn't say that I'm an expert on any one actor or actor's filmography from this period. You know what I mean? I'm sort of, I'm more like, feel like I watch a mix of a lot of different types of films. And really, because of the studio system and the way that it worked and the way they cranked out films, there are just so many. Like, you don't always have a common theme of seeing the same actor every single time. So I think it is hard to pick. But if I did, what comes to mind are for actor would be probably, oh gosh, that's so hard. Cary Grant is probably just very hard to
He was in one of the ones we watched, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think the thing about him that's interesting to me is like, he just seemed like such a really down to earth person. You know, he was the one that got treated like he was the king. You know, he was the one who was quoted as being like, he's the king of film, he's the star. And he was just like, no, this is like, this king thing is bullshit. You know, like, I'm just another guy.
Right.
And he was just like, I'm just another one of these people who got lucky and I had a lot of help. And he just seemed like a really humble, nice guy. But he also cranked out like some of the greats, you know, North by Northwest, To Catch a Thief, Charade, An Affair to Remember. Like, he did all the things. Only movie that he did that I don't love is Bringing Up Baby. And that actually has one of my favorite actresses in it of this era, who I would probably say is maybe my favorite, which is Katharine Hepburn.
Oh, okay.
And I love her, but I did not like that movie. I you know, and it's like a very popular film. It's lauded across the board, and no, not my
30 seconds or less. Why do you not like it compared to why other people like it?
I think I just found it really silly and obnoxious, and I found her really obnoxious, actually. Her character is really obnoxious, and the thing that I like about Katharine Hepburn in general is she always plays these really strong women with, like, such gumption and charisma, and she's really upending gender roles in most characters that she plays, and this is the one that I felt like she played the most straight and almost a bit whiny, and I just like, didn't love seeing her like that. But I think on the whole, she's probably my fave. But Bette Davis is excellent,
She owns this one for sure.
So you can't like have a favorite yet, but maybe of the ones that you've watched, of the four that we've watched, who was maybe your favorite to watch on screen?
I mean, the sad part is some of it like does blend together a bit, you know, watching four when I'm not really accustomed to a lot of the older films. So watching four back to back to back. I don't know, because there was a lot of overlap in the types of characters, and then there were some people who stood out, so I don't want to base it on just one single performance. I think I like a lot of the ones in this, because in this, everyone's a lot more conniving and sort of cutthroat in different ways that we haven't seen before. So I did really like Bette Davis' performance, especially as this was later in her career. So I'm not going to pick a favorite, but I do have some cool takeaways from this month for sure.
Yay. Okay. Well, that makes me happy. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar, and Merry Christmas, everyone. This is our December 25th. I just looked at the calendar. This is going to come out, so I got my little jingly sweater.
Nice.
It's going to make such a mess of this episode audio-wise, but Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, guys. I didn't even realize that. I also went with a hard left turn as far as theme, because I'm like wearing my snake earrings for, like, not to give too much of the plot away. There's definitely some snaky behavior in this one.
Multiple snakes, yeah.
multiple snakes, and it works for later too. Anyway, mm-hmm. fun times. But we are wrapping up Classics Month with our last entry, which is arguably my favorite classic film, maybe my top three films ever, maybe five, top five films ever, All About Eve.
Yeah, I enjoyed this one. Yeah, it was interesting.
I love this movie. It's a great time. It's another one of those almost like His Girl Friday where you just catch something new every time because it is, mm-hmm. it's not the same speed as His Girl Friday where you're just literally missing lines. It's just there's so many funny, witty comments in a row that you're like, wait a minute. You know, I love the witty repartee in this film. But anyway, before we get into it, we are both being challenged a little bit this week by our beverage of choice. What are we drinking?
Yeah, so we as you guys know, if you've listened to the past few weeks, we tried to keep it to classic cocktails in honor of Classic Month. So we're not going any too far outside the box, but we decided, or at Craft World decided, that we were essentially going to do a spin on a martini today. So I went pretty basic with mine of just 2 ounces of gin, 1/2 ounce of vermouth, and then I put a little olive juice in there because I'm a big olive juice guy.
Yeah.
But you did a spin on it, which is the one that at Craft World recommended for this, where you have the like cocktail onions, I guess.
Or cocktail onions. Yeah.
And okay, so that sucker's laying across the top of the drink. Have you eaten one yet? Are you supposed to eat it?
I haven't eaten one yet. I'm just waiting for us to kick off this baby. But look at this here for the listeners who watch also. This is the lovely cocktail onion, and it's a beautiful cocktail. This is actually a Gibson, and that's what they drink in the film. So that's Margot's drink, and one that, you know, everyone else kind of seems to adopt as well. So anyway, this is the Gibson, and I'm also not much of a martini person, and you changed yours up, and you devastated at Craft World when I let them know that he was not thrilled.
Instead of dry vermouth. Sorry,
yeah,
Skylar.
He was his face. I wish I could have captured it on camera. But anyways,
yeah,
I stuck to the for real one, but also not being a huge martini person, like, we're gonna see how this goes. So yeah,
I do want to say before we cheers, Mackenzie, as I sit here about to take a sip of a martini at noon on a Saturday, and I have a Christmas themed bar crawl in a few hours. I think our podcast has a drinking problem. I think this is something we need to talk about.
Listen, it's not before noon, so I feel like we're doing great. Like, we're not in the AM hours, actually.
It's the literal afternoon. It's okay. It's
day
drinking at this point.
Also, you're going to be trashed later. Like, you're going to have to Uber throughout the bar crawl because you're going to die.
I'm going to try my best, but hey, cheers.
Hydrate. Cheers. Okay, listen, this is not as bad as I expected.
Does the onion, can you taste the onion in the liquid itself? Like,
I think so. I think it gives it like a brininess. You know what I mean? Like a saltiness. And I love a little brine. You can ask Skylar. I mean, like, I love a briny oyster. You know what I mean? This would go great with oysters, actually. But it's strong. Like, you gotta be ready to do some drinking with this.
Yeah, martinis are just liquor.
It's just liquor.
No need to complicate things. It's just booze.
We threw in, I don't even know if the salt breaks anything down. You know what I mean? I think it's just straight fucking booze. So anyway, drink with caution, folks, if you do these. But pretty good.
I'm excited because spoilers, guys. We're going to be covering The Mummy next week as part of FanJan. And drinking this, I'm already horny enough for The Mummy cast. Everyone in that cast. This is going to get me real hyped up to cover it.
Well, since you already spoiled it, that's why my earrings work for both. They're very...
Oh, okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're recording both today. So yeah, it's going to be fun.
Are. You're welcome, guys. All right, back to the gem that is All About Eve. Okay, so basics are 1941, if you've never seen it. And 8.2 out of 10 on IMDb, which is pretty fucking solid. But talk about solid. Rotten Tomatoes, 99% from critics and 94% from audiences. So like... universally beloved film, this one.
I really enjoyed it. I think this might be my second favorite of the ones that we watched this month. I'm not gonna give it a 10 out of 10. There's things that I think could be done better, but I'm always gonna give that, hey, for when this was made, you see these archetypes of characters in films that we're still using today that are kind of not mimicking this, but definitely borrowing from some of these characters that we'll talk about later.
Yeah. I mean, there's some great characters here that are really rich. And I mean, I think it comes down to, this is one of the early film representations of this, right? Like, these kinds of characters exist, you know, throughout history, throughout art and theater and all the things. I love actually a comment that one of the characters makes where he's talking about Thespis, when Thespis first stepped out of the chorus, mm-hmm. and he's the first known actor to do a solo performance, is like the legend, right? It used to be like there were definitely choral type of stories. If you read like old Greek plays, that's great Greek tragedies, Greek comedies, etc., it's usually like a choral type of cast, a larger cast. There's a huge Greek chorus, there's a few core characters, but the chorus is a huge part of the role. And there's a reference to that here. And I think it's such a good callback, because like theater has been going on mm-hmm. for thousands of years in some form or fashion, right? And so of course these character archetypes do exist absolutely prior to this, but I think these are some of the early, really strong iterations of it in film. And I think that's what makes it really fun.
Yeah. The movie benefits greatly from the story being interwoven with this kind of meta story of performers. And it's kind of cool to see that play out. It's one of the earlier, from what I can tell, like sort of meta films in that way, where they're commenting on themselves mm-hmm. as performers in real life, and what the life of actors and actresses, and growing older, and people not really valuing you anymore because you're not as attractive as you used to be. Mm-hmm. So I think the movie plays that really well, to be very self-aware, and it's a little tongue-in-cheek and a little inside baseball at times, but still really, really fun.
Yeah, I do. I think it is. Like, I mean, if I think back on, I mean, again, not proficient at every single film of this era, I think it is one of the first to do something like this and like really mm-hmm. call out the situation that it is in and be more meta, like you said. I do think it's one of the first instances I can think of. Certainly later there's like Singing in the Rain does something similar in musical mm-hmm. form.
And Cabin in the Woods, which you loved. In horror
how did
form.
You work, how on earth did you work Cabin in the Woods to fucking All About Eve? Why? How?
So anyway, Dawn of the Dead 2004.
Oh my God. We're not going to trigger me today during my favorite movie, okay?
It's like seeping.
We're not doing
into,
it.
You're like, not today. Not today.
Not today, Satan. Not today, Satan. Anywho's, yes, there's, you know, there are later examples of it that are actually not super far later from this. Like Singing in the Rain was 52, I think. And but yeah, it's one of the first ones that does it really well. And it actually it gets into it like on a personal level with Bette Davis. You know, she's playing mm-hmm. Margot, who's in the exact same situation that she is as an actress, right? So we'll get into more detail there. But yes, I think it's one of the early sure. representations of really doing that well. So some of the basics are the director and also one of the writers is Joseph L. Mankiewicz. He's done things from a directorial standpoint, Cleopatra, Guys and Dolls, which even those I know are ones that like most of our listeners have probably heard of. Also, The Barefoot Contessa is probably one that people heard of. He did one of the early Julius Caesars as well. But from a writing standpoint, he had done the Cleopatra writing screenplay. And then he also did one of the other ones he's well known for is A Letter to Three Wives, which was pretty well received as well.
Yeah, he won the Oscar for that and this, mm-hmm. right? Back-to-back mm-hmm. Best Pictures.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, he was batting 1,000, this guy. But this is all based on Mary Orr's story, The Wisdom of Eve. And she was actually an actress. And she actually published this for the first time, again, fun theme here, in Cosmopolitan magazine, which, as we mentioned with It Happened One Night, is where that first appeared as well. So she published it there. She was paid like $5,000 for the story at the time, but she was not credited on the film when it came out for the original story. But she did end up winning a Screen Actors Guild Award for it, for writing it. So actually a bit more successful as a writer here than she was as an actress. But this was actually from an anecdote that she was told by another actress is what inspired the story. I think it was Elizabeth Bergner who talked to her about young girl that had been sort of a fan similar in this format and then ends up working in her household and turns out to be a bit conniving as well. So it kind of inspired the story in real life.
I'm sorry, I missed a little bit of the connection. So that actually happened to her after she had written this story, or that was the inspiration for this story?
that was the inspiration of the story from a friend of hers who told her this anecdote. So a friend, another actress friend of hers told her that she had been working on another perform. I think it was actually theater at the time. So it was same application. She was in theater and there was a young fan that ended up being a part of her employ and like working in her household and was her assistant and did all like all the same things that we see happen here and ends up being a little bit conniving and being written off as a terrible girl, I think is what they call her.
I'm glad that celebrities nowadays have sort of realized, hey, your fans might be a little, maybe vet them a little bit. Don't just hire them on day one to be your best friend and like housemaid. That doesn't play out well here. Yeah. So
really, you just can't trust anyone. You know, if you think about it, like everybody's out for themselves. Yep. Right. Yeah. Anyways, but I do think it's cool that she, you know, took this very real life story. And that's probably why it feels so authentic, too. So anyways, the cast and crew, major cast and crew, we mentioned, obviously, Bette Davis, legend that she is and was, plays Margot. She has done a bazillion things, but Whatever Happened to Baby Jane is probably one that people have heard of. She also did Deception, which I think was pretty popular. She did Dark Victory, which was one that I really liked. She has been in 124 films. So we're not going to list them all, but she did a little, she worked a little. Lady put in some effort here for sure.
I mean, she's playing it with like a burst blood vessel in her throat from like an argument with her. I don't know if it was just after the divorce or middle of divorce husband. And I guess the director actually really liked it and thought it played well with the character of this aging actress who's smoking cigarettes all day. So it plays out really well.
Yeah. She's got that nice rasp to her voice a little bit. And it's not too much. It's like it's a nice textured voice. And it does. I think it complements the role very, very well. But fun fact, she actually met and fell in love with her husband on this film. So she's just like ready to move on. Love that for her. Gary Miller, who plays Bill, you know, the person that she's supposed to be in love with here, they end up falling in love on this. So
he fell in love with her with that voice. So she had to keep with it that like voice. That forevermore.
Yeah, the rest she just kept it on forever. Exactly. But then we also have Miss Anne Baxter, who plays the conniving Eve. She has been in a number of things. She's a little bit like, again, legitimately younger than Bette Davis. So like she's a very different career than her. And it really like they cast these roles, I think, very well in that sense. She did the Ten Commandments, which I don't know if you ever saw, but was like a big movie. And I remember seeing it like the OG.
It was very short. Yeah. I don't know how they made that a 2-hour movie, but sure.
How did they extrapolate that out? I know. I remember watching that. That was a very long film, which actually this is pretty long for the time as well. This is over 2 hours. And the Ten Commandments is pretty long as well, but I do remember her in that. The Razor's Edge, The Magnificent Ambersons. I only saw Razor's Edge. I haven't seen Magnificent Ambersons, but those are things maybe you know her from. Also, Mr. George Sanders plays Addison DeWitt, which I both love and hate his character, and we'll get into why.
He's a bitch in this scene. I love him.
He is a little fucking bitch. Yeah, he's a real asshole, but he's also like one of the cleverest people in the room. You know, I
mispronounced that. He's a bitch. B-E-T-C-H. His initial opening monologue, like internal monologue, is great stuff.
Yeah, and fun fact, he is our narrator throughout the whole thing, and he does an incredible job of doing it, and you hear him before you meet him.
I don't want to like jump too far ahead, but I liked how there's kind of multiple narrators throughout this. Like he starts us off and I think he finishes us. Yeah. But in between that we get, and I was like, oh, I haven't seen that too frequently where we're going to let all four of the main characters give some internal dialogue of how they viewed the story. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I think it's a unique application of it. And you get their different perspectives on the same story and you get their inner monologue when things are happening that obviously they're saying something else than what's happening in the narration. So yeah, it's very well done. We also have Gary Merrill, again, plays Bill, falls in love with Margot / Bette Davis, obviously. And he's in Where the Sidewalk Ends and A Blueprint for Murder, two really popular ones. And Celeste Holm plays Karen. So she's another one of our narrators at a certain point, to your point, who's kind of giving her version of events as well. She did Gentleman's Agreement, High Society. High Society, I feel like, is one that people know, but Correct me if I'm wrong.
You had that on your list, I think. And I think I thought about that because I recognized it. It was another one. I heard that one. Yeah.
I can't remember the list. I've put it out of my mind because I worked so hard on it and nobody has read it. Anyway, whatever. Hugh Marlowe plays Lloyd Richards. He does The Day the Earth Stood Still and The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which I think is fun. Like if you've never, I mean, you maybe have heard of the new version of The Man from U.N.C.L.E., but with the cannibal?
Yeah.
Cannibal?
Isn't The Man from U.N.C.L.E. with what's his face?
The real life cannibal. Yes. Armie Hammer.
I haven't seen the movie, so I assume he eats people in the film too.
I was like, what are you talking about? The movie is so good. It's a Guy Ritchie film. It's genuinely like one of my favorites of his. And annoyingly enough, Armie Hammer is excellent in it. And yeah, guys, in real life, if you didn't know, Armie Hammer is a creepy cannibal. So I'm not going to promote it too much. Marilyn Monroe plays Miss Caswell. This is only her second major film role, and she has the most lines to date that she's had. She's done a lot of little bit parts and extra parts in other films prior to this. This is her only like major film role, and it was a big get for her at the time. It was like a turning point for her in her career. She had only a couple years prior switched gears and gone like super blonde, for example, changed her look. She did some work on her jaw, a number of things to just like be a stronger screen presence. And she got this gig after basically haranguing her agent into getting it for her. She had a lot of trouble on this set with Bette Davis. This is one of her standout, like people point to this as one of her breakout moments in film for her. Like people see her and she lights up the screen and she does a good enough job that she starts to get more work as a result of this. So this is one of the contributing factors to why Marilyn Monroe is Marilyn Monroe.
And it's another one of those references where it's kind of on the nose. I wonder if that was a conscious choice by the casting folks of, we need this person to play a young starlet who's trying to get ahead and is kind of, you know, using her charm and her looks to like get a role potentially. And maybe that was a conscious decision to be like, we're going to cast somebody who hasn't done a lot before. Like it's going to be very on the nose. Cause if we want to if you cast somebody who's been acting for 10 years, it's not going to play the same.
No. And I mean, she has this naivete about her character that she presents, but it's intentional. You can tell it's strategic, right? It's not actual. And she's very willing to, do what she needs to do to get the job. And, you know, this really mirrors life because Marilyn Monroe was very forthright at the time about the things you have to do as an actress to be successful. She was very clear that like she was willing and had given sexual favors for jobs. Like she was like, this is the landscape that we're working in. And to pretend that we're not is bullshit. And so she was really kind of groundbreaking in that way of just being exactly who she was and saying and doing things that were really risky and people respecting that about her. So yeah, she angled for this role and then she played that role on film. So it's a really interesting thing.
She does have that one line where she said, where he comes back and says, oh, I had almost forgotten your drink. And she says, I didn't. And just grabs the drink from it. She knows what she wants. She's tracking all this. She's playing people. And playing to her strengths.
But she is the younger actress on the screen. She was very intimidated by Bette Davis. Bette Davis like went off on her one time.
I heard drama amongst most of the actresses on this. It seemed like most everyone got along, but the two lead actresses and Marilyn Monroe, just a little bit of drama there.
Yeah, she made Marilyn Monroe run off screen and vomit. She was so stressed by the interaction with Bette Davis. Jeez. But you got to break them in somehow, right? Like this is the nature of the beast. No, I'm just kidding. I have no idea. But apparently she was a little bit hard on Miss Marilyn. But anyways, also we have Thelma Ritter, who plays Birdie, who I think is such a fucking gem. She should have been in the movie more. She's on screen, she's great. Yes, yes. She's done a number of things too. She was in The Rear Window, if you haven't seen it, it's excellent. Mating Season, Miracle on 34th Street, which is a classic. A lot of y'all have seen that, especially going on the holidays. You've probably seen that. She's a great time every time she's on screen. I'm like, give me more of Birdie, please. She's excellent. Quick plot summary for y'all if you haven't seen it before. A seemingly timid but secretly ruthless ingenue insinuates herself into the lives of an aging Broadway star and her circle of theater friends. So very simple, very accurate. Good reflection on the story. It starts with this ingenue, I want to be clear, also implies this like naivety about this person, like that she's going to be this, you know, young, up and coming, and she needs to be mentored, you know, and taken under her wing. And that's exactly how she plays it. Right at the beginning.
Can we say, so spoiler warning, if you've, you know, this 70-year-old movie, 80-year-old movie, but I got it kind of spoiled for me by the Prime description, because what you just said, I think, matches up. It's a young actress trying to ingrain herself within this society, right? I can't remember the exact way that Prime had it, or I'm pretty sure it was Prime we rented it from, but it basically said, Margot takes in Eve, you know, this fan who's an aspiring actress, but then quickly finds out that she is crazy and is trying to take her job. Like, it was everything.
Very
so then
detailed.
When the movie started, it seems to want to keep you guessing of who is really in the wrong here, because Eve is playing it pretty straightforward. But it seems like Margot is very suspicious and very paranoid about someone taking her spot. So I think it wants you to guess, but the fucking description spoiled it for me. So it's like, well, I know that Eve is kind of crazy.
Yeah, I just read the description and it's pretty much a spoiler. Yeah, pretty solid. Well, I also think they do tell us in the opening to some degree what's happening, right? Like, it's
that
not totally clear
ceremony,
but that opening award ceremony is telling us a lot. Like, this woman is accepting this award, the woman being Eve Harrington is accepting this award clearly from her theater community. And again, the narration here from Addison DeWitt's character the whole time, he's giving us this just beautifully eloquent explanation of the theater community while roasting the theater community and the people in this room. And it's so subtle but funny. And, you know, he says this one line that I love, where it's like this actor that the president of the society is giving the introductory commentary to this award, and he goes, being an actor, he will go on for some time. And it's so funny. And he's roasting him, but then he proceeds to go on for some time to give us this background, right? And he's a theater critic. So it's like, he's just as bad as them. And I think it's supposed to be, again, that kind of like meta reference of, you know, here's me reflecting this story back to us in this context as well.
Addison is a catty bitch and I love him. And I wanted to call out, because I'm sitting there listening and I'm like, where do I know this voice? And he's Shere Khan in the Jungle Book, like the tiger, like the 74, something like that. Jungle Book. I just went, why does this like really soothing but kind of threatening voice,
incredible voice,
pulling a part of me from childhood? And that's where that voice comes from. But I do love the book ending of starting the movie with this award ceremony, and you're kind of getting the backstory. You know that this is, and then when it comes back at the end, It's kind of a spoiler in a way of like, well, granted, it's a 1941 movie, but it's like, well, none of these people is going to die. We know they're all there at the end during this ceremony, but it definitely rings differently when you see all the interactions that got us there.
But you also see their faces. You get a tease out. Like, to your point, I love the book ending. I think the structure of this film is excellent. And I think you have this entry point where he's leading us down this pathway of the story that you don't fully know. But the moral of the story is that this woman made her way to the top, so to speak, right? But you see the faces in the room that are focused on at the beginning, and nobody's super happy about it. And even he's not super happy about it. He's an observer, right? Yeah. He's clearly observing the situation, and he's judging it, right? He's judging the situation. He's not necessarily happy or sad about it, right? He's just observing it with some snark. But the people who are impacted by the story the most don't look happy, and
there's a couple of like the forced polite no teeth smiles of like good for you, girl. And then there's a few where it's a little, especially Margot, it's a little more like, oh, there's jealousy or something going on here, right?
RBF is not, it's not RBF here. It is ABF. It is active bitch face. Like, she is not happy. I always tell people that I don't have RBF. I have ABF. And she is emblematic of this in this moment. She just like has, I wish I could do her face. It's this very subtle like eyebrow thing that she has where she's just, she's so expressive. And isn't one of the many things that Bette Davis is excellent excellent act. She has these, she almost reminds me of Meryl Streep in that way where, well, I guess Meryl reminds me of her in that way where there are these really minute gestures and like facial features and small subtle changes that they make that just tell you so much in like a micro gesture. And a great example of this with Meryl Streep was she was at the Oscars and she was being called out for The Devil Wears Prada from her Emily Blunt and Anne Hathaway stars who look at her. And then she snaps into her Devil Wears Prada character and it's just her face. It's just her face. It's 2 seconds of her face. And like Betty Davis does that too. It's just, it's so incredible. She could just flash her face and you're like, oof, there she is.
If you're one of those folks who loves that type of character, I've never seen The Devil Wears Prada, but I know enough about it of what those characters are like. I know.
I'm sorry. I know you super did. Well, it's actually, I can see how people would write it. Like some people would write it off as like, I don't know, like a cheesy rom-com. It's so good. Like,
oh yeah, I haven't been avoiding it. I've just never sought it out. You know, it's not like I don't want to watch that. But I was going to say for folks that like that bitchy character who like is just fun to watch do a lot of bad things, not even bad, but just like to not hide anything, to be snarky and to say exactly what they're thinking. If that's a character you like and you've never seen this, I highly recommend watching it because I think this Betty Davis performance is kind of where that started because she doesn't give a fuck about anything. And it's just, she knows how famous she is. She knows how wanted she is. She's leaning into it. And sometimes she can be really harsh. Like she's not a hero of this story, but she's definitely the protagonist.
Yeah, she's a real dick sometimes. And she also is very self-aware at moments too, which makes her endearing, I think. You have these moments where you're like, okay, she knows. Like she's not just a caricature. She knows who she is and has insecurities or struggles or what have you. And she knows that that makes her behave this way. And she calls herself out, you know, she gets yelled at by a lot of people. Right. But she will admit at one point in this film, very explicitly, like her major deficit really in her characters. And so she was really interesting to watch in that way, because this is very much a persona. It actually reminds me, weirdly, it reminds me of another Marilyn Monroe story where Marilyn's looking in the mirror at herself. She's drinking a glass of champagne and she's actually fully nude. And somebody asks her, like, what are you doing? I think it was her housekeeper. And she's like, I'm looking at her. And she's looking at Marilyn, right? The persona, not at her, right? Not at Norma Jean. And so like, this is very much, Margot has that same awareness, right? Of who is Margot, the actress, and who is Margot, the person, and trying to find those differences there. And she says it later. She's like, I want Bill to be in love with me, not Margot. Right? How do I know which one he's in love with? You know, and so like a lot of her insecurity.
Sick of her after like 10 years, and like
right, yes.
and that's why
she's endearing. I think is like you have these snippets with her, even though she can be very intense and harsh and hard to watch. You get to hear where it comes from, you know, and
the crisis of identity. She's trying to figure out who am I if I'm not this character, this actress, and even the line later when she's contemplating leaving the industry of maybe I should just go be a mom. It's like, I've never gotten a chance to be a woman before, which is a really strange but interesting thing to say.
Oh yeah, we're jumping ahead, but I will say that monologue, I both love and hate it because it does give you so much insight into her as a character and as a woman of the things that she just even is considering as part of her, what is going to bring her life meaning and intention and what, is it that she needs to be a mother to be fully a woman? And she goes into quite a long monologue about being a woman means not just being a mother, but being loved by someone. And if you're not loved by someone, and in her case, Bill, then you're not fully human. You're not fully a woman. And I obviously as a person struggle with that now of just like, we have value without the value that is projected onto us from others.
It's a 1941 quote.
It's a very 1941 monologue about like, you don't have value unless these things happen or are true. But you can see how real that would be, you know, especially at this time, and how that would really feel authentically like a struggle that she's having, because she's a career woman. Like she is fully dedicated to her career. She is on the stage. They say it in a number of different ways. You know, Margot doesn't miss a curtain call, right? Like, she's works there every night. You know, she'd have to be on her deathbed to not make it to curtain, mm-hmm. right? And she just works back to back to back. They write parts for her. She's playing constantly. You know, you can tell, like, this is work and a job, and she's a workaholic. So she hasn't gotten, in theory, to do these other, quote unquote, more normal, you know, life things for sure.
Yeah. I know that we are jumping around the plot a little bit, but I just wanted to, like, the version of her that we get at the party of Hurricane Margot, sort of like, she is calling bullshit on everything. She's talking about death and the inevitability of death. She is just hogging the jukebox. And by that, I mean the piano guy that she keeps making play the same song over and over again.
Oh my God, it's so harsh. She's like, play it again.
Yeah, she's going around telling, like, I love you, Matt. Like, she is, Hurricane Margot is a real thing, and I love her in that scene as well.
She's, Hurricane Margot is a fucking gem. Like, she's not, you know, you wouldn't be on the want to be on the receiving end of Hurricane Margot, but if you were at that party and got to observe it, much like Addison DeWitt, for example, like, mm-hmm. he's watching all this happen. He's very entertained by it. Like, that would be me. I would be, like, sitting there throwing Gibsons back and being like, well, this is worth a watch. Like, this is interesting. Get that popcorn ready, just watch her blow through the screen, and she picks all these fights, you know, and she says all these harsh things. And what I think is funny and interesting as I'm saying that out loud is I'm thinking about Addison is very much the same way, but he is given the deference to do it. He can do the exact same thing in every context. He can be harsh and unfiltered and real bitchy in certain rooms.
That's a product of his role, too. As a critic, right. Who the fuck are you trying to keep happy? I feel like Margot is an actress. And granted, she's got status at this point, but she has to make the director and the producer and all these people, like, impress them in some way, while Addison he's reins off. He reminds me of Littlefinger from Game of Thrones. Like, he's just playing the game of, like, I'm not going to be an actor, I'm not going to be a director, but how can I get as far ahead as I can in my current role?
But I also think it's, and I agree with that, but I also think it's indicative of how it is to be a woman in the same environment mm-hmm. versus how it is to be a man in the same environment. Of, you get away with stuff that she can't get away with, you know? And that's probably, like, I would imagine, and they don't say this in so many words, but I would imagine that's part of her frustration, right? Is, like, you can lose your shit. You can say inappropriate things. You can be whoever you want, the men in the room and the men in this production and the, you know, the critics in the room, etc. And nobody thinks that you're a diva or crazy or what have you. These things that they definitely think about her. And they're doing the same things, but just in different forms and from different angles. And I think the whole thing makes her throw her weight around a little. It's almost exaggerated for a reason.
I'd agree with that 100%. I think that's reflected in that quote that she has. I think some of this does come from frustration of being a woman in this industry, where she's talking about aging and women getting older. And mm-hmm. she has that really great quote where she's like, my husband looks 32. 5 years ago, he was 32. 5 years before that, he looked 32. 5 years from now, he's going to look 32. I hate men. That is such a great fucking line. And it is. It's speaking to the unfairness in this industry specifically.
Oh, yeah. And she has, number one, she has so many funny, great lines like that. And two, she does. She calls out the realities of this industry, of the situation. And she also kind of wants to lean into some of that, you know, for lack of a better phrase, battle of the sexes dynamic too. She does it two or three times. She also specifically asks for a role where, can't she just play a normal, nice woman who shoots her husband? You know, she like wants that role because she just, it feels like she wants to excise on stage these things, you know, and give her the chance. Just give her the chance. Yeah. Let her have this catharsis. Exactly. And so all that to say, I think Margot, aka Bette Davis, is just like a force in this film, mm-hmm. and she's incredible, but she is very much complimented and foiled by Eve, Anne Baxter's character, who is
behind the scenes playing the game, but not being as outright about it. Yep.
Yeah. She's and I think it also comes down, and you see this progression, we'll get there, but this is Eve early on with the stamina, the strategy, the conniving ability that a young actress still trying to make it is willing to do. So, mm-hmm. I mean, she meets Margot, she plays the fan, and she gets in with her via her friend, wife of the playwright, Karen, and she worms her way in and she just plays the room perfectly. And I think, I wonder, I would love to get your perspective as a first watch on this, but watching it now for me, every time it's like you see her acting. And I don't mean Anne Baxter acting. You see Eve acting in this first encounter in the dressing room and telling her story. And you come to find out that her story is 97% fiction, right? So you see her acting to win over the room. And she still has, again, all that energy, stamina, motivation to be this conniving. And you see that progression. I foiled against her in Margot, who doesn't have that stamina anymore, who has already made it, is already at the top, has her way. Like, she's done putting it. Yep. Right. She's not going to fangirl. She's not going to bust her ass to get roles. Like, she's done it. Check that box. She's fucking tired, mm-hmm. you know? And you see Eve, who's not, who still is like just ready to work and hustle and work everyone in every room.
Yeah, despite this being my first watch, obviously I had the thing spoiled for me, so I got to watch that scene knowing that there's probably something up. And I do think that's sort of, anytime you see a movie like this, since this, you kind of know when something is too good to be true, and it's like this naive country character who's just like down on her luck, but falling in with the celebrity stalking her in the alley. Just
seen come every to the show single every show night. Every
it's
single
like,
night.
Okay, something is definitely up. And that is one yeah. thing that I do want to key in on now that we're talking about both Eve and Margot together. Is one of, I think, the downsides in this is, for as much as I said, they want you in the beginning not to really know who's at fault here. I think it takes way too long to get to what Eve has been doing behind the scenes and that she's been playing her. It might be partially the length of the movie, but I just think it keeps you guessing for a little bit too long, where they're not playing up Eve's downsides at all. But they're also, I feel like they could have gone harder on just making you dislike Margot in the first half before the Eve reveal. I thought that Birdie had a call out in the very, like, the first 20 minutes where she says she's making a blueprint of you. She's trying to copy your every move. She's studying you. I think that we could have done without that line, because there's no other indication that Eve is bad until she kind of goes after her husband for the most part. I thought that, I wrote down, who's the villain here? Because Margot's being a piece of shit. She's showing up late to the read. She's changing the script. Eve is willing to stick to it. So we, as the viewers, with the exception of Birdie's line, are liking Eve at this point. But I think if you take that line out, it plays out a little more clearly. And it would have been more of like a twist.
See, I think there are subtle hints, and maybe that's, again, because I've seen it a few times, I'm not sure, but I think there are subtle hints that she is, like you said, you know, we, again, have the benefit of this award ceremony at the top. So we know that she's at least been successful. We don't know how she did it, but we know she's been successful to some degree. And she comes into this room and she's fangirling and all of that. I feel like, again, you can feel the acting coming off of her in that scene, which feels like it can only be a manipulation of sorts, mm-hmm. right? There's some ulterior motive here, and you don't know if it's, you know, to just use these people for their own success, not necessarily crush them on her way to the top, but just make connections that she needs to make. Or if it is like, I want this person's life. I want this person's job. And I think what you're left guessing is, which is it? Like, does mm-hmm. she just want a life in the theater, or does she want this life in the theater? And the way that she looks at Bill, and I even have this in my notes on rewatch, the way that she looks at Bill in that first scene, and he's completely dismissive of her, like he just is not interested at all. She is eyeing him.
Yeah, like enamored.
Like,
yeah.
Enamored. And I think, like, she's in New York City, right? There's a bazillion men in this city, right? She wants this life. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are subtle things here that she does or says a couple of times. And even the way she interrupts their kiss after being, you know, they're saying goodbye to each other, and she subtly interrupts their kiss while having offered to taking care of the luggage so they could say a proper goodbye. And then as soon as they're going to, she interrupts it. Like, she has these subtle things that are,
okay.
I don't think just being naive and being not noticing and not reading the room. I think she's reading the room and she's playing the dummy at the perfect moments that are strategic for her. And I think, like, again, it is subtle, but I think you are supposed to feel, like you said, that Margot's the worst at this point. She's yelling at everybody. She's hard to work with. Everyone's frustrated with her. And she is that foil of being sweet and kind and all these things. But what I love about Birdie, and there's always one of these, is that she is the best friend who is like, I have no skin in this game. Like, it doesn't affect me if Eve becomes successful. She's not coming for my job, right? Like, she is wanting to be her. She's not wanting to be me. And so she's just watching this happen. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't bring it up. She is asked, what do you think of Eve? And she's like, okay, well, you fucking asked. Yeah. And I love that moment, actually, where Birdie, like, just reads the fucking room. And but she's also the only one not being benefited by Eve at all, right? She's like, I can see this objectively because she's not here to help me. She's not here to be me. She's not here to do anything pertaining to me. So, yeah, I'll call her out, you know? And I think that's where, but Birdie then is less on screen. We want more of her. But because she's
so prevalent in the first, like, 20 minutes, and then she sort of disappears and she'll pop up here or there. And I know she still got an Oscar nom for this, which I think is very well deserved. But I just feel like that loyal character who kind of sees through the facade, I think they could have leaned into that more, because I wrote down, and maybe it'll help with a rewatch at some point, but even knowing that Eve is conniving by that spoiler, I still didn't see enough to get me there without that sort of on the nose. I think that they, at times it's a little too subtle, and at other times it's not subtle enough. Like, it's just, I think Birdie could have lent a little more of that, like, backing up Margot's suspicion rather than Margot just seeming paranoid.
Well, I think that's intentional, right? I think she's supposed to have, she answers the question, but in a way that isolates her from Margot, right? So then Margot gets in her own little echo chamber because she's already shut Birdie down. She's already said, you're ridiculous. You know, Eve is just here to help me and blah, 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 blah. And so now Birdie's not going to say anything else. Birdie's not one to meddle. Sure. You know, you can tell that. And so she's like, okay, fine. I said my piece. You don't want to hear it. I think she even says something along those lines. Like, I said what I had to say and, you know, I'm done with it, what have you. But right before she is asked is the midnight call to Bill that Eve has set up for them. Mm-hmm. And I don't think she forgot to tell her. You know, I think she wants her to be surprised and or miss the call and or be sloppy and a mess and not remember and get on the call and be called out to Bill of, oh yeah, I totally set up this call, or being so disoriented that she didn't set up the call, right?
I mean, like I said, you're drawing a good conclusion there, but I think that as a first time viewer, that's asking me to do a little bit of the heavy lifting. It would have been better if she were wasted and Bill calls and he's like, you told me to call. And she's like, oh, happy birthday. Like, I think they could have been
I don't think it's obvious. Yeah, okay. I don't think it's obvious. I think it's subtle. Yeah, yeah. I just, again, on rewatch and I'm seeing this a lot, like, I think there's these nefarious small things that you don't realize. But again, that call happens and then Eve asks her and she's like, she's studying you. You know, and if you think about the call with that context and that feedback, like, why doesn't Margot take that more seriously? You know, and why doesn't she consider her friend of what, 13 years, whatever, you know, years and years on the stage together? And she dismisses that. And I think it's, she doesn't want to see that this person has become integral to her life. And I think Eve did that on purpose of, I'm going to become so important to her and make her life so easy that she can't possibly think that I would be doing anything to hurt her, you know?
Yeah.
When obviously she is.
This is one of the two that we've watched this month. This and Maltese Falcon, I'll say, are the ones where I think this does, for the time, this does it very well. But I think future iterations of this type of story, like the tropes, I think they get tightened up. I've seen it done a little bit better, even though this is probably like breaking some boundaries and doing things for the first time. I do think when you look at movies like Black Swan or something, I'm trying to think of another one where it's like one character is a star is suspicious that this person is trying to take stalker comes in and is like doing some weird shit, but the main character is kind of not sure if they're losing it or if it's actually, I think it's been done better since. Not to say that this isn't good, but I think I needed a little more clarity in some of these parts.
Yeah, I mean, I personally think it's really strong. And I think part of it is because, you know, Eve is leaning into her youth and Margot treats her that way too, right? Margot calls her a kid, you know, Bill asks her at one point, what do you want to drink? And she's like, a milkshake, you know, she just has this, And at that point, she's a little paranoid, obviously, so it's a little snarky on purpose. But she can tell by that comment the way she thinks of Eve in her head as this like young child who doesn't know anything and couldn't possibly make some of the moves that she's making. And she's very preoccupied with age, as we've seen. You know, she's preoccupied with her own age. She's preoccupied with Bill's age. And then, of course, with Eve's age relative to her. And I think Bill is such an important aspect of this because even though this story is definitely about Eve and Margot, really, you know, Bill is one of the precipitating factors in this whole thing devolving, right?
Yeah. And I mean, we've touched on that, of the fact that it's not just about the career track. It's not about the starring role in this.
Oh, it's about the life.
Yeah, it's about the life. And it's about she is not only suspicious that she wants my job, but she thinks she wants the husband at some point too, and which does end 100%. Up kind of happening. So,
well, and I think what's interesting too is that she wants the theater life, the theater husband. And you see her make compromises for that at multiple points, right? Like, she'll take whoever she can get, but really Bill is the ideal. And what I think is great about Bill is that, especially at this time, he's a really solid representation of a man. Like, he is a really, and I mean this in the best way, like in today's terms, he's got healthy fucking boundaries. Like, yeah. He has healthy conversations with Margot. He tells her, like, you know, calm down, speak to me like an adult. I'm listening. I'm here for you. I'm a fan of yours. Like, you're not too old for me.
He's very logical.
He's very logical. He's very reasonable. He calls her on her bullshit, but in a like respectful, funny, nice way. He's in love with her. He shuts Eve the fuck down, right? Like, Eve makes a move and he's like, no. Hard fucking
no. His quote there when he says like, oh don't God. Cry. Just, it's an incomplete forward pass. So that's a freebie for any of you out there on the dating scene of, you know, somebody goes to kiss you, you're not interested in incomplete forward pass. That's the way to go. Women love football metaphors.
Oh yeah. That really lands. It is the best line. And it's so dismissive. It's so dismissive. He's like, don't take it hard, kid. You know, just an incomplete forward pass, but he's calling her the fuck out and he wants it to hurt. It's subtle and it's not like drawn out. But he wants her to be embarrassed and he embarrasses her, you know? But I think, like, again, he's the most mature person in these rooms in a lot of cases. And he handles Margot very well with deference, puts up with a lot of her shit, calls out Eve, doesn't succumb to her, you know, attempts at seduction, what have you. And he draws healthy boundaries for himself and is like, I'm not going to be pulled into this thing that you're making up in your head. And it's just it's just refreshing to me to see a man that you can respect and relate to treating the women on the screen with respect and boundaries and healthy conversations and communication. This is not common for this period. And I love Gary Merrill and Bill's character for that reason. And the writing of him, because he comes off great, actually.
Yeah, I think Bill is sort of like a stalwart just presence in this, where he's just very hyper-focused on like, getting the job done and trying to like live out their best lives together. But the one thing I will say is that post-audition fight where Eve has auditioned for the role and that whole blow up there with all of them, that is intense as fuck.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really hard scene. And I think it's also, you see, Margot doesn't play it right. You know, you see why she tries to play it the way she does, of like playing dumb and having them to have to admit it to her. But she needed to have committed to that. You know, she needed to have committed to, I had no idea all the way through. The fact that she reveals that she knew before she walked into the theater that Eve had read for the part and had done so well is what turns everyone against her, because it's like, it now becomes about her manipulation instead of them lying to her. And so, yeah, it becomes this really intense knockdown, drag out fight. And it breaks all these relationships around her. You know, it breaks this relationship with Bill. It breaks the relationship with Karen's husband, who I forget his name at the moment, but you know, the playwright. And they have this huge fight. And she's like, I love her line though. She was like, all playwrights should be done dead for 300 years. And him coming back with, wouldn't solve their problems because actresses never die. And like, it's just this, that whole fight is intense, but like incredible. It's so well done.
I like to think that this movie inspired, what is it, the Friars Club roasts, the ones they do on Comedy Central now. I feel like this movie was the basis for that. You know what'd be fun if we just insult the shit out of each other for an hour or so?
they do it so well. I mean, it is the blueprint for sure. And he, you know, he's like, he just has this, again, so many lines in this fight. He's like, it's about time the piano realized it has not written the concerto, you know? And it leads you into these very sad moments. She's breaking up with her playwright. She's breaking up with her boyfriend / partner. And their breakup does like make you really sad because Bill, again, has proven himself to be a good guy. And she's really shooting herself in the foot. But it does lead you to this interaction with Karen where she's pissed everybody off. So Karen wants to give her comeuppance, right? And this is why she kind of does this manipulation behind the scenes with the gas and they miss the show and all of this. But at that exact moment where she's made the decision to betray Margot to some degree and hide this thing from her, Margot has her moment of clarity. You know, Bill isn't there. She has lost Bill. She's had this terrible fight with her friends. And she's like, more than anything, you guys are the most important to me, the three of y'all, basically. And I don't want to lose y'all. And this is why I am the way that I am. And then you as the audience feel so bad for being upset with Margot, for Karen doing this thing to Margot, and they kind of win you back in that one monologue to Margot, I think. Yeah, so
as much as I said that the first half, I think, could have been a little more clear, that moment does play out where it's like, okay, we've hit sort of this middle part of the film, and now we're going to flip the roles of really who is the villain and who is the, not hero, but who are we supposed to sympathize with? And I do think that Margot earns a lot back just in that car conversation.
Yeah. And she says a lot of things. Again, she has that monologue about being a woman as well. And, you know, later where she's talking about, you know, being a woman, you've got to work at it. And you win every woman in the audience back in that monologue. There's parts of it, like I said, that don't translate as much today, but there are core parts of it where you're like, God, man, do I get it? You know? So she wins everybody back. And I also think she wins you back in the sense that like, she has been through it and she gets it. And this Eve character hasn't. This Eve character has just been manipulating things in her favor and not necessarily like, we're not seeing the same level of work, right? We do see her working at getting her way, but you don't see the same level of work in that sense. And so you start to kind of turn on her. And I think what ends up happening is, you know, luckily Margot, of course, you know, retains these friendships, ends up deciding to, you know, come clean to Bill and marry Bill, and they work their things out. And that's all so refreshing and it's comforting. But the thing that happens that you don't want to happen at this point, but does inevitably, is that Eve has also been successful and gotten what she wanted, but is being manipulated by Addison now. And like that, I wanted to hear what you thought about that. Like that, and I think on first watch is kind of a twist, right? Like that he would come.
It was
and
definitely.
Enter
I wrote
way.
Down like it's a wrestling term, but I was like Addison heel turn. Like he was always kind of a bitch, but here is where he takes control. And I think it's a little unnecessary. It is a cool twist. It's not something you're expecting. But him saying, well, I have dirt on you. And so now we belong together and we're going to rise to the top. But he kind of owns her. I don't think we need that. I think it's probably a way of showing that Eve is getting even more comeuppance at the end of.
Yeah,
she is a star, but does she really want it if she's being sort of manipulated and controlled by this man? And it kind of goes to what Margot has been talking about the whole movie. So I think it works, but I don't know that the movie necessarily needed it, to be honest.
Yeah, he has this great quote that I love about this. And he takes control of this relationship. And she, at this point, is trying to maneuver herself into Karen's husband's life. And she's trying to create scandal that you're left wondering if it's real, right? Like, is there anything going on there? Or is she just manipulating the people in the room and saying that this is happening?
I took it as more of like stories or that she is a little bit loopy. I did write down this movie is the story of a woman who loves married men versus a woman who loves drama. Those are the two archetypes here that are butting heads.
Well, and she wants people to think that she wants people to think that she's in the thick of that community. You know what I mean? She's borrowing on their names, even if it means she wants to be famous, but even if that means she's notorious. You know what I mean? Like, she'll take any kind of fame that she can get. And I think at this point she is maneuvering this thing that's fictional, right? She's telling Addison this is going to happen because he's her confidant at this point, right? I mean, she gives him what she wants to give him, but he's still her confidant. He sees her for the manipulator that she is. And she lets him see that, but she withholds certain pieces of information and she gives him gems that she thinks are strategic, right? She thinks he's going to leak this and she's going to seem important and it's going to cause the downfall of this marriage and it's going to cause her to be in the spotlight and all these things. And instead she gets the tables turned on her and he's like, "Nah, girl, nah. I know what your thing is. I know all your lies. I'm here to call you out." But then he says this great quote that I saved. He was like, "That I should want you at all suddenly strikes me as the height of improbability, but that in and of itself is probably the reason. You're an improbable person, Eve, and so am I. We have that in common. Also, our contempt for humanity and inability to love and be loved, insatiable ambition and talent. We deserve each other."
Yeah. Feels and like I a think, Game of Thrones. Like, it's like that dynamic, right? Of like, we're both chaotic, power hungry individuals. I could have still done without the him slapping her and like literally saying, "I own you now." I think there's, you could even tell it without there being a romantic like marriage of some kind. It could just be, "Hey, I got dirt on you. I'm riding your coattails to the top." It doesn't have to be romantic or sexual. It could just be like, "What can we do together to take over this town?"
Yeah, I would have liked that kind of, and I think if you made it again, that's what it would be like, right? It would be like, let's become partners in this versus I now control you. But I do think you can tell that story because it does make sense that like, this is a critic who, yes, makes himself very self-important and says that he's critical to the theater and he will always be there regardless of actors and actresses, right? But he still, I think a lot of times, you know, those folks are, it's like those who can't do teach. Right? He can't do it. He critiques it.
Yeah.
And so he wants, and he won't really admit that except to Eve, that he wants to be more in the thick of it. He wants to be more integral to the theater. And he can do that with her, right? They get to be this power couple. And now he's going to control her. He's going to manipulate her stardom to his advantage. And I think it's a big reveal about him, but it's also a big reveal about her that she's gonna go with it because it's better to be in this dynamic and deal with this control or any, you know, anything coming out about her to retain her fame than to be authentically Eve. You know, she's not gonna ever do that.
Right. I think the last couple things I wanted to touch on. At first, I didn't understand the logic of the dinner. Which I do love the quote of, "You can't just pick up champagne and drink it. There always has to be a toast." Stealing that.
Yeah.
Thank you, All About Eve. But the logic of when Eve is sort of negotiating with Karen of like, "Here's how this is going to go. I'm going to do this." It fell a little bit flat because everyone was already happy. Like, no one was really upset about Eve's success, but it's her seeking out this draw. I was like, that feels unnecessary. But then I realized the very next, when she goes back downstairs, Karen, it's really to show Margot's growth because she's like, "Actually, I don't want that role anyway." So that all that blackmail scheme is for nothing. Eve is sort of at the end of the rope because no one else really gives a shit about her. And that's reflected when we get back to the awards dinner and you can read more into the faces of them of, "Yeah, you got what you wanted, but no one here cares about you. You know, you're just an object."
Well, she is an object. She's an object of talent. Like, we can't deny that she's shown to be very talented once she was given the chance. And so that's the piece that Margot can't deny it. Karen can't deny it. Nobody can deny that she is very talented. And so now they're using her right back, right? He casts her immediately because she is the right talent for the job. But to your point, they don't particularly care about her, but she proves herself to, continue to try and manipulate the people around her. And I love the like flash forward again, the bookending of this ceremony at the end kind of brings everybody full circle. You now understand why everybody's faces are what they are. And you understand the narration and the overlay and all of that, but you feel like this group, you know, Karen and Margot and so forth have had their kind of closure and they're good. They're good where they are. But cut to Eve and Addison and you see that they're stuck in this really dark dynamic at this point. Mm-hmm. And you see that Eve is kind of held hostage by that, but that the applause is what keeps her going, right? She gets this round of applause in that room that's just you know, deafening practically. And it just lights her up and it fills her up. But that's what she's always seeking. That's what she says. She said it earlier at the party and she says it, you see it on her face again of like, that is what she is living for. And she will do anything to get that applause. But her alone in her room, in her hotel room, she's miserable.
And so that miserable is person. Where they should have ended the movie. I thought that was great of like, hey, you got everything you wanted. It's reflected, like I said, in the awards dinner of no one here actually gives a shit about you. You're just this prop that's going to eventually run its course and you will be thrown in the trash heap. Like, you know, unfortunately, like a lot of the actresses of that time, but like you did it so vindictively and with such malice that you won't even have friends around you like Margot has. But they should have ended the movie there of her being escorted back to her room and going to bed alone. I thought that was perfect. Then they bring in this unnecessary, I felt, oh, look, it's the exact situation we saw at the beginning. And now it's happening to her, but she doesn't care. And like, I'm sure there's more you can read into it, but it was just so on the nose of like, now I'm going to put on her clothes. I get it. I get what's happening. You don't need to spell this out for me.
I hard disagree. I think it's the perfect bookend. I think it tells you that this story has come full circle, like truly full circle. It's the real bookend to the story of how did she meet Margot? What was Margot like before? What did Margot do to get where she got? You know, where? How did she drive her success forward? It is clear that Margot's not immune to this behavior either, right? So Eve is just another iteration of Margot, and Phoebe, who comes in at the end, is implied to be another iteration of Eve. And I think what you're seeing is that like, this is the cycle of ambition and talent in this world. And Eve is going to have the same thing done to her that she did to Margot. And that's the real comeuppance that she's going to experience, is she's going to watch her career dwindle or change before her eyes. Age is going to come for her. All the things about Hollywood, like we're talking about, are going to come for her. And this young girl is emblematic of that. And I love that Addison just calls it out. Where he's like, do you want an award like that? And she's like, more than anything in the world. She's just like Eve. And he's like, ask Eve how to get one. Ask Miss Harrington how to get one. She knows all about it. And so I do love that like closure of like, she's going to get exactly what she wants exactly what happened to her. Because I think, yes, to your point, you can see that she's alone. But I think it's more on the nose to see that like her karma is going to be very cyclical. It's going to be just the same.
You can tell that without it being a mirror image of what happened at the beginning. Personally, I think it takes away the uniqueness, the specialness of Eve and how crazy she is.
But I think that's the point.
She's not special. So is the point that every actress in, I mean, I want to say Hollywood, it's not Hollywood, but like New York,
right,
is this same exact archetype of like stalking their favorite actresses to take their role. I get that it's meant to be that it's cutthroat, but that to say that, oh, well, that means that Margot did this same exact thing. Like it takes away the specialness of the story.
I don't think the implication is that it's every single actress. I think it is that there is someone like this in every generation. Right. And Eve is maybe the one of her generation, and maybe Phoebe's the one of the next one. Right. But that there is a generational, relentlessly ambitious character, and they do it with women in this case. Right. But it can be anybody. It can be men. It can be women who are relentless in their ambition. And Addison has shown that in his own space, in his own world, that they'll do whatever they have to do to go win this story. And I think the point is that in this moment, it's been all about Eve, but it won't continue to be all about Eve. You know, she isn't special in the cyclical story that has come before her and will come after her. And so in a number of ways, she did get what she wanted. She got the life that she wanted.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I just think you don't need the new stalker situation to tell everything you just said. You just summarized all of how Eve's story plays out. And I think you could have done that without literally mimicking the situation at the start of the film. But
yeah. And I don't know, like, again, when it came out, I don't know that you could have done that, right? Would the story land the same way in 1941 if you don't put it on a silver platter like that?
That's true.
Maybe it's probably not going to land in the same way. And I think this is a film that was, again, lauded across the board from critics and audiences. So it felt very authentic to end it that way and almost poetic. Which is how I would describe it, definitely as a poetic film. But with all that, you know, obviously it sounds like this is one of the ones that you enjoyed more of the month. What was your rating?
Yeah, I think this was enjoyable. Like I said, it's cool to see where a lot of archetypes come from in modern cinema. And I think a lot of people who have never seen this would probably enjoy it. I think there's, like I said, a couple of things that I would change, but I'm critiquing a movie from 80 years ago, so what the fuck do I know? It probably went over really, really well, but I think when you've seen more films like this, I think I've seen a couple that do it better and a lot that have done it worse that are clearly trying to ape this. But yeah, I just think there's a couple misses in it, but overall, really enjoyed it. They also had a very good, I didn't get to mention my favorite Sandlot-esque insult in this, which is "you venomous fishwife." I think that's a great Ham could have said that during that roast battle in the Sandlot. But yeah, enjoyed it a lot. I would say probably 7.5 range, something like that for me.
Wow. That's pretty good. I can't think of a film, in my opinion, that tells this same story as well as this one, especially as wittily as this one.
The script is really tight.
This is just written so well, and I think the casting is excellent. And again, it's very meta in how they did that and how they leveraged that casting. And I think it feels so authentic, and it gives you insight into these characters and into this world. And and I just love the witty repartee of it all. I can watch it a million times. So I would give this a solid like 9 out of 10. Okay. I love this.
I know
movie.
You really like this one. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of my favorites. And I think again, it's all the combination of things. It's the acting, it's the production. We didn't even get into some of the production that I think is really interesting about it and that it's done well, but it's great. So anyway, thanks for going on this classics journey with me.
For sure, dude. I saw a lot was on my radar, just never thought to sit down and watch them. So I had a good month.
We got him here kicking and screaming, and then at the end he had a good time. So that's
I feel the same after Street Fighter next month. Kicking
absolutely not. I am not thrilled, but hey, I'm doing it. I said I would do it. But no, I am not excited, which brings us to our next points. Thank you guys for joining, but come back next week for what has become a little tradition for us here on the pod, a little fan jan. You probably have seen, by the time this comes out, you will have seen a couple of polls about some of the films that we are doing, your favorites, your requests. We are going to start with a fun one, as we alluded to and spoiled at the top, The Mummy.
I'm really psyched for it. I just rewatched it last night, and God, it's still fun. It's not perfect, but it is still fun.
And I should be clear, the 1999 Mummy.
And not the original. This will not be black the original. And white. We're done with that.
Yeah. Lamar's fucking over it. He's never going to watch a black and white film.
Pleasantville,
again.
And we can watch Sin City. I'm trying to think of what else. Schindler's List, I guess, eventually. Yeah.
Well, it is a fun watch, I will say. I am excited to do that one as well. But yeah, come back next week and join us for The Mummy. But in the meantime,
yeah, follow us on our socials at We Drink and We Watch Things. Instagram's where we're most active, so anything you got, send there. You can also email us, We Drink and We Watch Things pod at gmail. I think Mackenzie's checking that semi-regularly, but I'm more of an Instagram boy.
I get all the notifications for all the things. Okay, so good. If Lamar won't read your email, but I will. Don't worry.
Yeah.
All right. Well, homies, go now, have a drink, and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.